Welcome to this latest session of Lunchtime Takeaways with DPP. My name is Ollie Rea. I'm your host for these sessions. If you're new to these, then I'd like to welcome you in. For those who are returning, you should know the format by now. Some informal sessions that we like to run this time on a Friday, just to kick some ideas around, see what's been in the news, and just to share some knowledge, really. It's a bit of a forum. As you may know, we do like to record these sessions to put them out afterwards in the form of a podcast for those who might want to listen back or for those who are unable to attend. So you've got a privacy notice on screen to that effect now. Obviously, any issues with that at all, do just let us know. They are your sessions as much as they are ours, so please do get involved. Any comments, questions, concerns, queries, anything at all, if you just pop them in the chat, I'll try and keep an eye on that, or just either raise your hand or dive in and unmute. You know, we have a tremendous propensity to rabbit on, so you just need to get stuck in, really, if you've got anything to say. I'm joined this week, as ever, by my dear colleague, David Holmes. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome.
Lovely stuff. And so, as I say, a normal session this week. Well, actually, not quite, because as those of you who are regular attendees and listeners will know, we normally dive straight into the news at this point. However, we have got, actually, a very exciting new segment to bring you this week. We are absolutely delighted to have on with us Tony Allen, CEO of AgeCheck Certification Scheme. And you may have heard about this in the news this week. It's a really, really big deal. So we're absolutely, absolutely delighted to have Tony on to discuss this with us. And so we'll be talking a little bit about that right now. Good afternoon, Tony, and welcome.
Hi there, Ali. I'll put my camera on so people can see me. Hello, good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me along to talk to your session today.
No, we're absolutely delighted. I'll be keeping my camera off, though, unfortunately, because I think the listeners have gotten used to that by now, and I wouldn't want to shock them. So, obviously, absolutely huge news this week. But before we get into actually, you know, what this announcement is, Tony, if you could give us a couple of words on yourself, your background, and your team over at AgeCheck Certification Scheme, a little bit about yourselves, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. So, my name's Tony Allen. By profession, I'm a chartered trading standards practitioner. Spent 20-odd years in public service working in trading standards, both locally and nationally. My specialist area was age-restricted sales, so that is preventing children from accessing content, goods, services that they shouldn't have access to. The last couple of years, we've been developing this certification scheme, which we're going to talk a bit more about in this session. We've got a team here based in Stockport, just south of Manchester. We've got 19 here in the office. We've got 2,500 in our test crew. I'll explain all that when we talk about what we do. And we have a series of freelance auditors and consultants that we work with as well on the project. So, yeah, looking forward to explaining what's gone on and what's been happening over the last last couple of days in terms of the announcement, but the last couple of years in terms of preparing for the announcement.
Fantastic. So I'm sure actually most people in this session will be aware at this stage. It's obviously extremely big news. Effectively, the case is that, Tony, you guys are the first business to have a scheme criteria approved by the ICO. The knock-on effect of this being the approval of the ICO under Article 42.5 of the corresponding certification scheme, which is absolutely massive. It's the first of its kind in the UK. It's something which we've been waiting to see happen, and it's something which personally I'm very excited about. I've done a lot of work on the age-appropriate code practice recently, so it's very exciting. But it's not just the one scheme, is it, that you've been working on? You've actually got two currently. Could you tell us a little bit about the two of them and about the difference and what those cover fundamentally?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, absolutely right that we're the first to be approved under Article 42.5, not just under UK GDPR, although we've left Europe now. It's the first one anywhere in the European Union as well under the old GDPR. So it's been an interesting, exciting, frustrating, challenging process as we've been pathfinding our way through the various requirements. And working with the ICO very closely over the last couple of years. We have got two schemes approved. So before I just describe those two schemes, it's probably helpful to discover a little bit more about who we are and what we do. We are an independent certification scheme. We test that identity and age check systems work. So if you have in your online system any kind of age gateway or ID gateway, we will test that that works. So that means looking at everything from biometric assessment, what's called presentation attack detection, which is spoofing measures or anti-spoofing measures, ID document scanning, show your driving license to a camera on your laptop or on your phone and whether it can extract the data, right through to mystery shopping, where we will send one of our test crew. I mentioned we've got 2,500 test crew out there using an app that they're all 18, 19 years old, and we would send them to try and buy alcohol or tobacco or gambling products or whatever in a shop or a premises and see whether or not they're asked for an ID. So that's kind of the old mystery shopping style through to advanced biometrics and analysis. And a critical part of the whole thing of ID and age assurance is this concept of data minimization, data protection, and all the things to do with GDPR. So we took a decision. Looking back, it was, I think, the right decision, but it was it certainly had a lot of consequences to apply to be a certification scheme under GDPR. And we started that process 2 years ago. And so one of our certification schemes is the technical requirements for data protection and privacy for identity and age assurance service providers. So companies out there, and there are lots of them, Jumio, GBG, Yoti, Age Checked, Verify My Age, there's a whole host of them. We can assess their GDPR compliance and issue a certification of conformity with the backing of both ICO and UCAS. The second scheme is relating to the age appropriate design code, because during the course of us developing the first one, we had a lot of discussions with the ICO about what was then the forthcoming code and then became the actual code. And since then they've been working on how they're going to approach their supervision and enforcement of that code. And we agree with them to basically put together a certification scheme covering the age appropriate design code. And the scope of that is different. That is much more for information society services, companies that actually provide services to that are likely to be accessed by children and young people. And so those are the two differences. One is aimed at providers of identity and age assurance services, and the other one is aimed at information society services that have the need for age-appropriate design.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tony. Yeah, absolutely fascinating. There's a point you touched on, I suppose, very slightly there, and it's one which instantly sort of caught my attention when we were talking about this before, is the concept of you working obviously very closely with the ICO over the course of this. And I just wondered if you had any particular insights or anecdotes or anything to come out of that process of working with the ICO and what that was like over such a big project.
Yeah, I mean, I think just one thing to bear in mind is that the certification schemes, although it's 2 years since we started the process, the whole concept of certification schemes has been at least 10 years in the making. Obviously, it's in GDPR, but prior to that, there was 4 or 5 years of discussion about whether they would be used, whether they'd be any good, whether they would be supported. And so there is there's a long history to it. And the European Data Protection Board had put out quite a lot of detailed guidance. So on their through the working group 29, they had created a whole series of what the accreditation requirements were, what certification schemes had to meet, all the hoops that we had to jump through. So there's quite a lot of bureaucracy already there that had been created. And then obviously what we then brought along is, right, okay, we're going to present to you some schemes. And it was the first time that any of the supervisory authorities had actually used that EDPB accreditation guidelines in the wild. because they previously they were very theoretical. So we had to go through that with them, and it's definitely been challenging because the practical reality of running a certification scheme against the very what you might describe as quite risk averse nature of what they wanted for everything to be covered and all the controls they had in place did create some interesting discussions because as an example, we are independent, we're impartial, we're covered by UCAS, we are covered by ISO 17065, which is the international standard for how you do certification, which has got extremely strict confidentiality clauses associated with it. When we are dealing with clients, we have to have that open conversation between an auditor and the client. And we had to protect that from the ICO basically at one point sort of suggesting that they ought to be able to see all of that. And we said, no, we're quite happy for you to know that there is that somebody's applied for certification because we think that's important. And that we are going to issue certification, but the conversations between us and the client have to remain confidential, because if they think that we are simply there talking to them and then we're going to pass all that information back to the regulator, that's never going to work as a relationship. So there's quite a lot of debate and discussion about how that would work in practice. I think we've reached the right conclusion with that, which is that we notify them of the application. Which is great for us, also great for the client, because it effectively means that that client is then, the ICO will defer to the certification process rather than sort of start or look at enforcement action necessarily against those that are going through it. And then also it will, at the end of it, you will get the, they will get a notification that the certification has been issued, so therefore that's also great for the client because they have got effectively registered with the ICO that they are a certified system, certified data protection processing and system, and that means that they will that will be taken into account by the ICO when it comes to risk profile of that particular organisation.
Of course. Fascinating. Well, I have to say I'm rather jealous in all honesty of being able to get involved at that level, that level of insight. Absolutely fantastic.
What I'll say about the team as well, Ollie, is although there's been challenges and it's frustrating because when you're dealing with bureaucrats, it's always frustrating. They have been brilliant. The team at ICO, particularly the assurance team there, have been absolutely brilliant. They've been very patient with us. As well as us being patient with them, but they understood that, this was pathfinding. They were, when we set off on the journey, they weren't entirely sure exactly how the certification scheme criteria would be presented. I know they're looking at obviously different ones. Although we're the first to be operationally live, because we've got our UCAS accreditation in place. There is another one that the scheme criteria has been approved for, but the scheme is not yet operational because they haven't got their criteria. So they have had a bit of a comparison. I think they've also, to be fair, had quite a lot of what you might describe as chancers who didn't really understand what certification was. They've also sort of put in bids and they've had to obviously deal with, you need to go away and think about this a lot more. You need to consider it a lot more. You need to think about exactly how you're going to do certification in an independent, impartial, confidential way that inspires the confidence of clients.
Absolutely. And admittedly, we sometimes on this session have fallen into the trap of giving the ICO a little bit of grief, but I'm sure that, to be fair, that's on their enforcement action more than anything, which is an entirely separate topic, but it's always nice to hear a good endorsement of their work in that capacity. That's fantastic.
Just brief as well, because there's been challenges, but to be overall, they've done a competent, thorough, definitely done a lot of due diligence on us and our systems and our processes, they've done what you'd expect them to do. I just wish they'd done it a bit quicker, but they've done what you expect them to do.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that, Tony. That's absolutely brilliant. I say we're very grateful for you coming on and giving us the lowdown on that. Is there anything else you wanted to cover in relation to this news, particularly that you wanted to get across?
Well, I'm happy to answer any questions. Other than that, if anyone is interested in it, then do either contact us through DPP or you can visit our website at accscheme.com. And we also have a special website, which is ageappropriatedesign.accscheme.com, which is specifically for the Age Appropriate Design Code, because that is obviously a different strand and a different client base for that. But basically, just to sort of talk you through the basics of how that will happen is, thanks Mariam, just put the link up there for us. The process that we go through with you is a three-stage process. It is, first of all, what we call a policy audit. So that is, what policies have you got? What materials have you got? What have you done in terms of data protection impact assessment or privacy policies, all that sort of thing? And what is it you're setting out to do? So what is your age-appropriate design policy position? What is it your business is setting out to achieve? The second thing we then do is what we call a quality audit, which is, how do you control that? So how do you make sure that that policy is being implemented, and how do you manage your approach to implementation and sort of devolving it through the organization? And then the third thing is we call a technical audit, which is, does it work? Have you actually done what you said you were going to do? So have you actually, if you said in your privacy policy you're going to do X, Y, and Z, is that what you're actually doing? And so those sort of three stages take you through all the requirements in GDPR. We also have, to support people, we work very closely with what we call conformity assessment advisors. And so if you are stuck, if you're not sure, there's no requirement for you to use any of our conformity assessment advisors, but we do have them available. And we also, obviously, with people like DPP as well, I'm quite sure they would help you out with those services as well. So, it's a relatively straightforward process, but it is pretty in-depth. So be prepared for people having a right good look at what you do with GDPR.
Excellent. We wouldn't have it any other way. Well, thank you so much, Tony. Links in the chat there for those who are interested, or as Tony says, you can reach out to him directly or via us, whichever you prefer, if you're interested in finding out a bit more. Tony, I believe you're sticking around till the end of the session, so I suppose if there are any other questions, do just shout up or pop them in the chat.
Or just link through to us. But if you don't want to do it publicly in the chat, send us a link via the website. Or if you just want to catch up with me afterwards, I'm sure that Ollie or the team can put you in touch directly.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, thank you ever so much, Tony. We're extremely grateful. Dave?
Sorry, Al, I was just going to jump in there, just because I know we need to progress on to just having a look at the other bits, and Tony has done a really good job. I'm really interested, actually. I'm just trying to get my head around where you'd actually start if you wanted to go through a certification scheme. You talked about, Tony's talked about there, about a lot of the challenges, and there could well be lots of learning and really interesting and useful bits that we could benefit from that. And the only I was just going to pose it to Tony, or ask Tony, is how did he bring it all together, and has he got some form of case study or overview as to the steps that he went through and some of the learning that potentially could be taken from that?
Yeah, thanks, David. I would say that how we brought it all together was, it was half accidental that we ended up going down this path, and that was because we were running a certification scheme for identity and age check practices. An aspect of that was GDPR. And we wanted to get UCAS accreditation for our scheme, but there was no easy route to do that. And the only route that became available to us was this GDPR route to get the UCAS accreditation. So that's what drew us into doing it in that way. I think in terms of what we then produced and prepared, you basically need your technical requirements or your standard or your checklist or what you're going to assess. We call them technical requirements, but you can call them whatever they are. The first thing to realize is that there is no off-the-shelf set of requirements that you can submit for this. There is no, you can't use 27701 because it's hopelessly inadequate for covering GDPR. You can't just simply rewrite the accreditation requirements that EDP have put out and put them into a document and go, there you are, we just, you know, copied and pasted it and said, that's what we're going to do. You have to tailor the individual requirements to, first of all, you've got to sort out the scope and understanding the organizations and what they call the TOE, the target evaluation, is covering. And then all of your requirements have to be tailored to that scope. So you have to work out what would happen if you were dealing. So let's say you were doing criminal records certification scheme. You would have to tailor all of the requirements from GDPR into how that applies to a criminal records environment. Obviously, we've done it for ID and age assurance. So it's an incredibly big piece of work to do that and to get all of that in the system. It also has to go a bit further than GDPR does, because obviously GDPR is principles-based. The age-appropriate design code is principles-based. You can't have principles-based auditing. You have to nail your colours to the mast. So you have to go and say, right, what is it going to be a requirement to do? And anything that's a bit wishy-washy, you have to work out how you're going to actually audit that. So a big bit of work around that. And then you then need all of the stuff that goes with being a certification scheme. You need impartiality panel and committee. You need a certification body. You need an evaluation process. You need an appeals and complaints process. You need all the confidentiality requirements, all the issues around getting the logo that you're using trademarked. Well, in fact, it's not a trademark, it's what's called a certification mark. So it's a different process for that. And then you need to put all your protection in for all of that, how you would enforce it. You need to work out your fee structure. Broadly speaking, for those of you who want to know how much this is going to cost, it's roughly similar to ISO 27001 in terms of amount of audit time and the cost. The method of calculation is based on sort of size of company in the same way that 27001 does. You just put all of that lot in place. Then you have to get UCAS to accredit all of that. Then you have to get the ICO to sign off on your scheme criteria.
Seems like we've just lost Tony there. I'm sure he'll be back very shortly. Oh,
sorry,
you're back.
It looks like I dropped out there briefly. Apologies for that. But hopefully you caught the end of that, what I was talking about.
I think we more or less did. So there's no problems there. Yeah, I don't know if you had any other questions on this, Dave.
No, it might be something just to kick around to Tony afterwards. I just found the whole process quite fascinating of where you started from, where you're going, how you achieved it, what you need to pull together. Because for those who are aware, we're doing something similar, not from accreditation, but from a code of conduct. And again, there could well be some analogies there. Obviously, different setups and things, but it could be some analogies there with our own code of conduct. So I was just kind of interested in some of the process, but maybe want to chew the fat with Tony outside of this, because I appreciate there's probably other stuff you wanted to cover, Ollie.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to talk about this all day, quite frankly. But yeah, so any other questions at all, please do reach out. We're very grateful to Tony for his time and his insights on this. I say either
my,
in the
my
chat
feel
or
for the my, sure. my feel for the code of conduct things is that I'm not saying it's easy, because there's a big bit of work involved in that, but it does seem that there seems to be more codes of conduct coming through rather than certification schemes, and I think that's because codes of conduct don't involve UCAS in what they do. So you've got that slightly more straightforward. This is a code of practice or code of conduct, and it's just agreeing that with the ICO. Whereas the certification approvals process, the reason why I think it's taken so long for the first one to come to fruition, not only here but across Europe, is because of the involvement of accreditation bodies and the whole of the international standards around accreditation.
Okay, interesting. No, really interesting. And Yeah, and when you said it's across Europe, did you have to have kind of involvement with European enterprises as well, or was it how did that element come through?
Well, it's interesting because it is across. This is the first certification scheme under any of the GDPR jurisdictions. Of course, we've had Brexit in the middle of the whole process that we've been working with. So we didn't, in the end, have to go to the EDPB for approval of the scheme. But I think we did. ICO did that informally because it was the first one, and they didn't want to, embarrass themselves by doing something which was going to fall outside of EDPB's kind of what it wanted to see. But we didn't. In the end, we didn't have to do that formally because we've obviously left EDPB in Europe. We do certification across Europe though, so we have a number of clients across the European and indeed outside the European Union. So we are currently working with the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, just literally starting that piece of work with them and looking at how we might be able to develop a data protection seal for the European Union, basically taking the template model that we have here. But I would say, and the Irish Commission have been quite open and honest with it, that they are 6 months away from being able to start that process. We're probably a couple of years away from having something that covers the whole of the European Union. But it's definitely on the roadmap for the future. I do think the ICO were quite considerably ahead of the rest of the supervisory bodies in Europe when it came to looking at how they were going to approach these certification schemes.
Excellent. Well, fascinating. I'm really interested to see how it develops actually across the European regulators as a result, and whether that approach is mirrored, and how quickly we might see that taken up actually across the other regulators. I know actually, just as a bit of a segue, we have got some news on International Data Sharing Day that you've put on my notes for this session. So, if you wanted to cover that as the next point, but I don't know if you had any other questions before we segued.
Not at all, not at the moment. Like I said, there's probably more kind of thinking about it. It'd be lovely to, like I said, just have a catch up with Tony. Just generally, just having a bit of a chat about it. There's like I said, we usually find things we can go on for far too long, maybe. I'm just cautious that we maybe just need to kind of progress. So if anybody's got any questions for Tony, please do either unmute or drop them in the chat, and we can come back to Tony in that sense. There's certainly a lot more I'd like to ask around that, but it's I might be just pick up with Tony outside on those points. If we're okay to continue, we can jump straight into the points around Europe, if you like. Well, it's kind of how the UK. The ICO has recently published a draft international data transfer agreements that they're out for consultation. I don't know if anybody's seen that. Did you see that, Ollie?
I did very briefly, but I've not had a chance to get to grips with it fully. So I've seen your rather comprehensive notes here for the session, so I'm happy for you to take the lead on this and walk us through it, if that's all right.
They're only very loose notes. So I would urge anybody who's interested in providing feedback for the consultation process, do look them out. The ICO promoting them on LinkedIn and elsewhere. Do look at them, do read through them, print them off and forward your own thoughts back. So anything in here may well change greatly or to a lesser degree as a consequence of the consultation process. And you've got till the 7th of October to do so. So therefore, I don't think just realistically looking at the international data transfer agreements and the bits that sit with them that I'll take you through shortly, I don't think there'll be kind of formalised possibly until the start of the new year, just looking at how things and the kind of progression of things through then. But in essence, to start off by highlighting really that the new EU standard contractual clauses aren't valid for transfers under the UK GDPR. So anybody who's based purely in the UK with international transfers, thinking about relying or transferring over to the EU new standards, and I'm sure we spoke about those before, Ollie, in relation to what the new SCCs look like. In that sense, we can't rely on them. So the ICO has made clear there in the draft guidance. The draft international transfer, international data transfer agreement comes with, there's a draft international transfer risk assessment tool. That's part of the consultation process, which is in essence the UK's version of the European Data Protection Board's recommendations. There's also a draft international data transfer agreement, which will be the UK's version of standard contractual clauses. And rather kind of pragmatically as well, and I think it's quite a positive, well, potentially a positive move. I'm happy to hear anybody else's thoughts on it who's maybe read and pulled it apart more than I have. But they've also got a draft UK addendum to the European Commission's standard contractual clauses. So therefore, it can work in tandem with them to stop any multinational flow of information possibly requiring two different local transfer mechanisms. So I thought that was quite a bit of a move. I don't know whether that's kind of facilitates easing of relations between the EU or whether it's kind of just taken as a more of a pragmatic step, as in that facilitative approach to commerce in that sense. The transfer risk assessment tool is voluntary. You can certainly look to other methods in there at the moment. It's where the transfer risk assessment potentially, once you've completed it, indicate that it's unlikely for the transfer to go ahead. The exporter may consider a more detailed risk assessment or allows you to rely on other appropriate safeguards or exemptions. So it's not necessarily something to read in isolation. You can certainly add in other bits and pieces around there. One of the questions I was going to pose, again, just seeing if anybody's asked or anybody's kind of read around this, would be that there's a difference with the transfer risk assessment in that it provides assessment steps for the exporter to assess the risks of harm that the transfer causes to the data subjects, and then allows the transfer to proceed where there is a low risk. So, for example, and it's only posing a question, I'm not suggesting I've read it enough to have an answer, but if you can go through a risk assessment and you can determine that there's the transfer is low risk, so for example, it's only name and email addresses and you're using a US platform, does that mean it's possibly a way to circumvent as a measure to support flows to the US of low risk data following the Schrems II agreement? So it'll be interesting to see how that one might pan out, what that looks like. I've certainly not scrutinised enough. If anybody has, then please do jump in and let me know. I'll be certainly interested to find out whether that's whether the transfer risk assessment could be used in that way, where you look at is only low risk data. You could look at what's the likelihood of using MailChimp and broadcasting newsletters being regularly requested or picked up on by the authorities in the US, and therefore if you deem it sufficiently low risk, whether that could go ahead. Have you got any thoughts on that, Ollie? I know it's probably something I've just thrown at you, but have you got any thoughts on that one?
No, it's interesting because I mean, I've obviously, as some on here may know, we're particularly prevalent, or we historically have been particularly prevalent in the social housing sector, and as part of that, and also with a whole host of clients in other sectors, obviously the likes of MailChimp and SurveyMonkey and other platforms like that are US based, you know, we deal with them a huge amount. And I've often since obviously the Schrems II ruling, had this sort of back and forth with clients. They say, well, we need to make sure it's done properly, etc. I'm saying, yeah, we need to make sure we go through the steps. And if we do go through the steps, then, I mean, obviously up until this news that you're sharing here, we were effectively basing a lot of what we were doing on the European equivalent. So talking about European essential guarantees, for those that remember, and going through that risk assessment, implementing potentially supplementary measures in line with recommendations 01-2020 from the European Data Protection Board and XYZ. And fundamentally, you know, that's A, a very onerous process, and B, there's a sort of voice in the back of your head when you're going through it going, well, you know, how much of this can we actually control with the likes of SurveyMonkey or MailChimp? A, because, you know, the balance of power is not in our favour. But also B, at a certain point, you have to think that a lot of this came about because obviously statute like FISA in particular, for the big one, wasn't it? Section 702, I think, of FISA was one of the main sort of one of the main culprits in relation to TREMS 2 and the fact that it provides US intelligence agencies with the power to request data extraterritorially, effectively. That's part of it, isn't it, Dave? That's part of the issue.
Yeah, they...
There's a lack of...
In essence...
Lack of oversight.
Yeah, I was just going to say, just covering off ICE, in essence, it's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it's actually aimed at non-Americans or non-US citizens in that sense. So it is looking at outside of the US, or possibly even information in the US that's not necessarily concerning US citizen data. In that sense, it's the supremacy of the FISA Act, and I think there's an executive order or some other kind of document with it as well, isn't there? So it's just looking at the fact that that's supreme, and therefore that necessarily or may well water down what the standard contractual clauses, if you're trying to rely on those, and the protections that the GDPR offers.
Well, that's absolutely right. And then obviously you do have to bear that in mind when you're going ahead with these transfers. But the point I was ramping up to, the point I was making, was the fact that, you know, if you're a housing provider in England, let's say, or any sort of, you know, smaller business in England, and you want to use MailChimp, at a certain point you've got to ask yourself, are you really sure that the US government or, you know, the FBI or whoever's going to come requesting your customer data? I mean, there's a certain element to that goes, I'm not sure this is really sort of affecting us. So all that to say that, you know, the idea that you talk about there with this transfer risk assessment, and that if it's low risk, you can go ahead with it, I can't help but think is going to be a good thing fundamentally. Add a little bit more common sense to the mix almost. And also there's been a bit of a void in terms of guidance from the ICO on this. So it's nice to get a steer effectively.
Whether it'll actually work in practice or not, I'm not sure. We'll certainly have to look at it and see how it falls out, especially see what might come out as a result of the consultation process, because things may change between now and what finally is approved or decided on after the consultation process. But I certainly think for the starting point, it looks rather pragmatic, which can only be a positive thing in that sense. In the same way, it's looking rather pragmatic with the addendum or the draft addendum to use alongside standard contractual clauses. So I think it can only be a positive thing, and it's nice to see a bit of pragmatism coming through. Linked in and otherwise, it's the there's not a great deal of movement between data sharing as a transfer mechanism between the EU and the US. They've certainly been talking about it for the last year and progressed very little as a consequence of it. So if this offers a more kind of pragmatic risk-based approach, or if it's very low risk data in that sense, yes, it might be going to the US. If the only thing that you're worried about is a FISA Act, well, is it necessarily a problem? What's the likelihood of it being pulled? Is only low value data? You're still going to have to go through the justification for that. Mm-hmm. Arguably, you're still going to have to make sure that you document your thought process, so you've got some form of accountability and evidence to demonstrate what your thought processes were at that point. So there's still a little kind of the governance of it all still to apply and to retain for evidential and auditing purposes and so on in there. But it certainly looks like a far more pragmatic solution, I would have thought.
Yeah, I'd have thought so too. I do apologise. I haven't been keeping an eye on the chat during that segment. I was sort of staring off into space as I was talking. Rick posing as a scenario here, which seems rather complex, but maybe that's just the way I'm reading it. But effectively, talking about a data subject's point of origin is in a third country, the data comes in from the third country, and on providing information back to the subject, we are putting info back into a third country without supplementary measures. Do we then need FCCs for any inbound agreement, despite the other entities not needing to comply with GDPR? Crikey. I think I know what you mean, Rick. I think I know what you're getting at. I mean, you're welcome to obviously come on and kick it around if you'd like. So I suppose you're saying whether you need to put in place some contractual clauses, supplementary measures, where effectively the majority of the processing is happening in a third country. It relates to a third country data subject. And
yeah, Ollie, can I jump in?
Yeah, please do.
Yes. So, I struggle with the question myself. So what it is, so say if you, you run a business and you're not actively marketing to, you know, that country, so it's not in territorial scope, but, you know, you have a contract in place with let's say there's an organization in China and, you know, I'm looking after healthcare. So say then patients come in from China, there may be special classificator, no doubt, because they'll be sending in a referral. So that will come in for that path. But then if we're then saying on return of that information. So therefore, you know, a summary care notification going back to their, you know, their GP or, you know, in effect. So that data then would be high risk data going to a third country, but the third country is their country of origin, and that organization that receives the data doesn't need to be GDPR compliant. So would we then, because we're responsible for holding that information and it has to comply to GDPR because we're in the UK, do we then need to put in place CCCs, which they possibly won't sign because they'll think that signing that contract would then mean they have to comply with GDPR. So it all gets very complicated. So sorry if I didn't explain that properly.
No, it's fine. Don't worry. I think I was getting there. I was piecing it together as I reread it. I think, well, my initial feeling on that is, would you not, I mean, if you're talking about sort of one-off instances, would you not sort of rely on some of the exceptional circumstances exemptions, so things like relying on consent or performance of the contract, I think, as some of the ones where you can go ahead and make a restricted transfer without the need for either an adequacy decision or some contractual clauses. That's why, I mean, that's my gut feel, but that's literally sort of right off the bat, and I don't know whether actually that works, but I'd have thought if you're doing occasional, that's probably the way to do it, rather than, as you say, implement what is fundamentally a very burdensome agreement, a set of standard contractual clauses for very sort of rare processing scenarios.
I am leaning towards the consent, so if we can do that, then, you know, but yeah, just
thought I'd have thought so. Yeah, by all means. I mean, I don't know if you want to come in, Dave, if you had any thoughts on that, but I think that's my gut feeling is that's the route you'd look at.
Yeah, sorry, I was just trying to think it through, but yes, possibly. I'd probably just have to look at a little bit more context, I think, around that.
Yeah, for sure.
There was something within the consultation paper where the ITO asks several questions around interpretation of extraterritoriality and transfers, and part of that is looking at whether processing relates to non-UK based controller that's targeting on monitoring behaviour, and that's being processed, understanding, in the UK. And the kind of then questions around the relates to scenario, and it looks like the ITO is leaning towards processing by the overseas, or in this case, the overseas process being governed by the UK GDPR. But so I'd probably just look at the consultation paper first, see if that gives you any idea. But again, it's looking for feedback and questions and queries. It may well be something quite suitable to post to them if you've got a controller in another territory and all you're doing is acting as a processor in the UK and which bits bound you to it in that sense. But yeah, interesting question.
Thank you.
For sure. Michael, you've got your hand up. I don't know if you want to dive in on anything here.
Yeah, we've had a couple of cases like this. We put the emphasis back on the patient. So we'll have somebody who's been treated in the UK, but they may want to take some of their data back to the specialist. And we kind of almost see we provide the data to the patient directly. It's then the patient's decision. I think the look we have there is the patient is actually in the UK when they're making that decision. They're not necessarily already back in India or China, but we tend to put the emphasis back on the patient to make that decision to take that data back to the third country, rather than perhaps dealing directly with the hospital or health organisation in that third country. But that's the simplest way we found to do that. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for that, Michael. It's definitely a tricky one. But hopefully, Rick, that at least gives you some food for thought, or at least some reassurance in terms of what you're doing. Cameron making the point that the consultation paper appears to say that if you identify that the processing is low risk, that a DPIA is likely not required, which I agree is interesting. There are a couple of people, Dave, actually asking if you had a link to the consultation paper, if possible, and whether you could maybe share that with the session.
I'll just go through it while you continue.
For sure. Katie asking another question in relation to this, which is, and I have to say, I've toyed with this idea a little bit myself, so it's good to raise it, I suppose. is the idea of, now that we've got an adequacy decision, whether you would go to the trouble of implementing SCCs and additional safeguards with organisations in the EU from a UK perspective, even though we've got an adequacy decision. And that's an interesting one. Obviously, you wouldn't be required to, but bearing in mind that this adequacy decision is the first one which is which has got an expiration date against it, hasn't it? Or a review date, at least, if not an expiration date. It's an interesting one. Obviously, it gives you that additional layer of security if you wanted to go through the process of it. I think the additional complication in this type of scenario, and this is one that I still sort of have to kick around regularly, is where you're potentially sharing data or processing data in the union, but it's only a data center for, say, AWS, an American company. So you're relying on maybe their Irish servers or something like that. And there's an additional complication there, because in theory, even though it's still in the EU, you're not effectively protected from FISA, are you, Dave? Because that would still apply. So the premise remains the same, obviously still bearing in mind a degree of pragmatism that FISA or those using FISA are probably not going to be interested in what you've got. But the principle's still the same, in that it's undermined. So at that point, do you go through the process of implementing SCCs? I think you maybe do, to be on the safe side. I don't know. Did you got any thoughts on that, Dave?
Yeah, well, you're right. If you're looking at the FISA, so the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act from America, that has extraterritorial reach. So arguably, as long as you're a US company, I think there's probably some other requirements around, but in essence, as long as you're a US company based on US soil with operations in other countries, and potentially they could enforce access to that data through those countries, through those companies, should I say, in that sense. So it certainly has extraterritorial reach. I mean, I was reading around elements around the FISA Act. The reason why it determined its extraterritorial reach, because there was another act that it replaced, and the act that it replaced was actually held by US law not to have extraterritorial reach when challenged in court. So that was repealed and replaced, if you want to use those terms, by the FISA Act. And therefore, the older commentary suggests that a FISA is extraterritorial. So it's a valid consideration, as if you're still using US-based companies, even if their data centres are EU or UK-based, what measures do we need to make sure that the information is potentially not caught by the extraterritorial reach of FISA?
It's very tricky, isn't it? It's very tricky. I hope that at least helps in some capacity, Katie. But it's something which I've definitely grappled with quite significantly.
I think the key to it is standard contractual clauses on their own, as you know, weren't invalidated by Schrems II, but they weren't enough on their own just to rely on standard contractual clauses without doing an assessment and without necessarily looking at essential guarantees and supplementary measures to make the protection. So as a starting point, I wouldn't just rely on SCCs without doing all that kind of background homework and make sure that you've got those measures in place if you're going to go down that route.
Yeah, of course. Rick asking the question whether the ICO and whether the UK and EU would recognise each other's adequacy decisions going forwards, which are obviously going to be different. I know that obviously currently we basically just adopt the EU ones because we haven't really gone through that process ourselves. Whether somewhere down the line we might decide to start giving out adequacy decisions which conflict with the EU's reasoning, perhaps if we, from a political and economic standpoint, start to cuddle up more to the US and China, which is not entirely, which is not unlikely, all things considered, whether we might start to consider giving them adequacy decisions, and that would probably, if not conflict, at least contrast with the European decisions. It's certainly an interesting point.
And I think it's interesting.
I don't have an answer, to be honest, at this stage.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think it relates back to, and by all means jump in, Rick, if necessary, when the EU were assessing, or when the EC was assessing the UK's adequacy, there were some concerns more about onward transfers out of the UK of information that might have come to the UK from the EU, and not necessarily just looking at the UK's adequacy in isolation because of how much we followed European law over the last however many donkey's years, that kind of thing. And I think there's a bit of a concern in relation to onward transfer out of the UK and what that might look like. So I think that's quite a really interesting kind of concept, as in if somebody in the UK then sub-processes to somebody in the US, for example, if we deem the US to be okay and the EU doesn't, how does that affect? And I think some of those areas were getting the EU a bit twitchy, and measures around that. Coming back to the actual question itself was whether the European Data Protection Board would recognise each other's, possibly if there's less politics involved. I think if you're talking governments, there's more politics, but to recognise adequacy would be more governmental level, not the ICR ECB level, or the European Data Protection Board level, I would have thought. So as I thought, there's probably more politics in supremacy of EU law and that element of it, possibly.
Sure, for sure. Yeah, certainly an interesting topic and plenty to kick around. I mean, there always is on this sort of thing. Just moving on to any other points of news. I've got quite a few, Dave, although it's more just sort of headlines that I've seen kicking around that I thought were interesting. I've certainly seen some of my network discussing these on LinkedIn, so thought we could pick a couple up. But I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to cover at this stage.
Only a real couple of minor ones, really, just because then it's a little bit of a link, just because we're looking at health data only a few moments ago, that the first UK fine under the GDPR in the UK was a doorstep dispensary. I don't know if you came across that one or saw that one recently. It was the fine was for, I think, about £275,000, but the doorstep dispensary has recently appealed it, and it's now been dropped to £92,000. It's still quite a chunk, but obviously a lot less than the £275,000 that it was originally pitched at. And there's just thoughts about would you think that's going to necessarily fuel criticism of the ICO again with the enforcement action, especially in light of BA and Marriott reductions potentially from what they were initially badged. We can all remember ICO was saying that BA's was 180 odd million, I think it was to start with. So it was just quite interesting. It's it kind of came across that it was challenged to the first tier tribunal. And ultimately, although it's reduced, a lot of the FTT supports the ICO's original monetary penalty notice. And I think the reduction was because of some factual discrepancies. But again, just a quite interesting kind of little case there. If anybody wants anything on that one.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And I mean, despite Tony's excellent account of working with the ICO previously, despite some frustrations, I fear that we may enter the giving them some grief on enforcement section. I'll tell you something that I saw this week, which I just didn't really understand, and a few people on the session may have seen this, but last week we had a statement out of the ICO, or it might have been the week before, but recently anyway, we had a statement out of the ICO basically warning consumers not to hand over too much data when using apps to order food or drink in pubs. So obviously this is something that already existed pre-pandemic, but obviously has become more sort of desirable in the context of the pandemic, which is, yeah, you can order food or drink in a pub, bar or restaurant on an app on your phone. And so, yeah, the ICO coming out saying, well, you should be careful, you know, don't, I think the headline was something like, don't swap data for drinks. And yeah, all right, fair enough. But I hate to say it, the first thing that came to me is, have they really got nothing better to do than worry about this? I mean, I checked in the lead up to this session off the back of this headline. I've currently got like three apps on my phone for ordering for those purposes. And they only ask for a name, email, and maybe one of them asks for a phone number, you know, and that's it. And it's not even a mandatory phone number. So I hate to say it, but I'm fine with it. I don't have an issue with it. And honestly, I think they're bigger fish to fry.
Do you think it's more just kind of attention headlines, that kind of thing?
Well, possibly. I don't want to be too down on. I don't want to be too cynical, because we often sort of get into that. But I did sort of think, you know, really, is this that important? Do you know what I mean?
For sure.
The article that was written, and I can share the article if anyone wants it, but Michael making the point, was about 18 months too late, which is probably sort of in keeping, I suppose. But the article that I read on it was a BBC one, and they were sort of making out that all pubs and bars, they can use all the data you give them to build profiles on you and better market to you X, Y, and Z. And I'm sorry, but I don't really believe that. I mean, I don't know about anyone here, but I don't really receive very many emails from my local, and
well,
generally haven't got too great an understanding of what I like. So,
well, yeah, I think there's two points. Firstly, I think possibly the ICO is maybe just grabbing a few headlines, that kind of thing. Yes, you might be potentially subject to marketing, but if they're doing the marketing compliance right, then they'd be making you aware of that, especially if you kind of want Friday afternoon offers, that kind of stuff. They may well be profiling you to make sure you get more targeted ads, and that could be potentially done in a compliant way as well. But are they actually doing anything different to anybody else who may have your information from a commercial point, quite frankly? And I'm not trying to boil it down, but it still comes back to, if they're going to do it, they've got to be compliant in it, in that sense. And I'm not quite sure whether, I absolutely get your point, this is just bigger fish to fry. If you've rather than saying don't give too much information over kind of information for pints or data for pints, whatever they did, the headline was, I also saw the article in the news, I think you should be telling people, just read. You know what I mean? If someone's asking for information, just understand what they're asking it for and what you're doing with it. And whether you're happy with that point, and if you're not happy, don't do it.
Did anybody see the article about Sainsbury's and the cat food saga, about it having to be recalled, but they didn't notify the pet owners because they had unsubscribed from marketing emails, and there was a bit of an uproar?
Yeah, well, that's an absolute pet peeve of yours, isn't it, Dave? Particularly in housing, people sort of asking to have their contact details deleted and then you can't get in touch with them.
I've seen it, not just in the housing sector, but in a lot of other sectors as well, whereas if somebody unsubscribes, that means I can't communicate at all. And it's like, well, that's not really the case, is it? If the service emails are a requirement to communicate with them, then you've still got the opportunity to do so.
You would have thought that the size of Sainsbury's would have understood Pecker and the legalities of touching base, especially with something that had to be recalled.
Well, to be fair, I mean, you're absolutely right, but to be fair, I mean, it's kind of similar, but a different sector. It wasn't so many moons ago when it came out with all the issues with Baby P and Damilola Taylor, where there was welfare concerns, but all the people involved were going, well, I didn't think I could talk to anybody else about it. You know, I mean, the law's not there to stop that, is it? Let's be fair. And if there's welfare concerns or there's product concerns, you're not marketing to them. It's not, can you return the product and you'll get a buy one, get one free offer, or we'll put you in for a free draw. It's a case of your cat might die if you eat this stuff. You best stop feeding it to it or whatever. You know what I mean in that sense? It's, the law's not to there to stop common sense.
No, well, I mean, without wanting to, as per usual, sound too cynical, Brian, but when you say that you'd expect someone of their size to understand this, I frankly wouldn't, because the amount of large organisations or even public bodies which still, you know, don't seem to have a clue about what any of this is, and you've still got the government coming out and saying that you have to have consent for certain things, it absolutely beggars belief. Cameron shared an article which I don't know if it's the same one I saw, but I at least saw something very similar. I'm aware we're running out of time, but I thought I would at least mention it because it's on a slightly less light note than we've had thus far, a slightly heavier note, which is that the US military, during the sort of occupation in Afghanistan, have been using biometric recognition technology, basically to process and profile the local population. And during their retreat, they have lost control of some of that technology, which has fallen into the Taliban. And the Taliban now, in theory, have the potential to access biometric records on a whole host of local population, including informants and people who worked with the military, which does not bode well at all. There's a really good piece. I didn't read the BBC one, Cameron, but I can share a link to the one that I caught it in. It's just baffling, quite frankly. That there was so little thought put into this beforehand, seemingly. I don't want to sort of leave us on too heavier a note, but it's certainly worth reading for those interested.
I would support that. I've read something similar in, I think it was actually in the BBC News as well, about some kind of retina scanning, was it? That the or tools that the US used in Afghanistan, and have lost control over them, and that kind of thing, and now the Taliban are using it to try and identify individuals and things. It really is concerning. But actually, yes, only is that image down there that you just put into the chat. It is absolutely scary, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, we need to wrap up now, but the flip side of this being that what that article details at one point is that reportedly the Pentagon had set a target of profiling 80% of the local Afghan population. As part of this, and that is frightening. You know, it's just frightening to have that, those types of records. And now all of a sudden, because you're not controlling it properly, it's falling into the wrong hands. Sometimes you need to think about these things a bit more carefully. Anyway, on that incredibly joyous note, we probably do need to wrap up. I noticed a couple of people are having to get off, so we shan't keep anyone any longer. There's still plenty of bits of news to cover. It's really, you know, big week in terms of news. But we will be back very soon with another session anyway, so anything that we've missed, we'll try and cover then. And obviously any other questions, please do hold on to them till then, and we'll cover them. Or if not, just reach out to us, and we'll be able to cover those off. I'd like to thank Tony once again for coming on and sharing his insights. Fantastic to have you on, Tony. We're really, really grateful. I mean, we'd be more than happy to have you back on one of these and possibly dedicate the whole hour to it, because it's a fascinating topic. In terms of our next session, Miles has popped the link in the chat there for all those interested. We're taking a quick week off next week. Some of us are on leave. We'll be back the week after that on a session dedicated to training and awareness. We're actually running another competition on that session for those interested, potential to win 10 hours of free support with our support desk. Do get involved. There's a link there for those who want it. So thank you all for attending. We really appreciate it. Another fantastic session. Thank you once again, Tony, ever so much. And thank you, Dave, and all those who have contributed thus far. And we hope to see you all very soon. Take care, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. Take care, Tony. Thank you for joining as well. All the best, everybody. Speak to you soon.
Have a good weekend. Thank you.